This hour's top stories, India registers a record single day of over 386,000 new cases of the coronavirus and nearly 3,500 new deaths from the disease. Brazil becomes the world's second country to pass 400,000 COVID-19 deaths and amid warnings, the daily toll could remain high for several months due to slow vaccinations. Also ahead, clashes break out between security forces and protesters in the Colombian city of Cali as anger mounts in the South American country over a government plan tax reform. Welcome. India has logged yet another record daily rise in its coronavirus cases as it faces severe shortages of medical supplies. The health ministry on Friday registered over 386,400 new cases in 24 hours. That takes India's total tally more than 18 million, the second largest in the world. The country has been posting record after record, that is, in its daily COVID cases in the past few weeks. That has been blamed on large gatherings as well as people's reluctance to wear masks. The explosion in infections has caused a severe shortage in hospital beds and supplies of oxygen. A number of countries have pledged aid and assistance to India. The U.S. aid has just arrived there. We earlier talked to our New Delhi correspondent, Munawar Zaman, about the coronavirus crisis in India. He told us how tragic the situation is as the country is grappling with an explosion in cases.
Well, the hospitals have broken down. They're overwhelmed. There is nothing they can do. They're trying their hard to save as much as life they can. And you wouldn't imagine. They have to make a choice, whom to give the oxygen, whom to give the ventilator. I mean, they have to make the decisions in seconds, depending on whose conditions is what. I mean, the situation is out of words. There is no word that can describe the situation. Till yesterday, we were talking about shortage of oxygen supplies and shortage of beds. Now, that's something which is not to be spoken about now. Now, the biggest trouble the country is facing is the lack of crematoriums, lack of food, lack of burial grounds. I mean, it is the biggest trouble now the country is facing because people have to queue up to get their loved ones buried, to get their loved ones cremated because there is no space left.
Dire situation in India, indeed. Brazil registers more than 3,000 new COVID-19 fatalities as the country's overall death toll surpasses the grim milestone of 400,000. The U.S. is the only country where the coronavirus has claimed more lives. Brazilian Health Ministry also recorded nearly 70,000 additional infections, raising total cases to more than 14.5 million. Health experts have warned the daily toll could remain high for several months as the Latin American country struggles to secure enough vaccines while loosening restrictions. Elsewhere in the Americas or Americas region, Mexico has reported 529 new deaths from the virus, along with some 4,000 more confirmed cases. Germany has reported more than 24,300 new cases from coronavirus in the past 24 hours. The figure declined by 400 compared with the daily case tally reported Thursday. Germany's total cases are now over 3.38 million, with nearly 83,000 deaths. On Thursday, Health Minister Jens Spahn said the number of infections seems to be heading lower, but he added the decline is not yet deep enough to suggest the third wave of the pandemic has been broken. Germany's efforts to contain the third wave is complicated by the more contagious UK variant and a relative slow start to its vaccination campaign. Officials say few cases of the Indian variant have been detected too. Colombian protesters and riot police have clashed on the second day of demonstrations against a tax reform package proposed by the government. Clashes broke out in various locations, including the city of Cali. Reports say one person died there in what was called an incident related to the demonstration. Colombians took to the streets in major cities Thursday for the second straight day. They defied a court order ruling that the marches should be postponed because of a spike in COVID cases. The government has said it will act against demonstrators breaking the law. The proposed reforms would increase taxes on individuals and businesses and eliminates many exemptions. Revelations about prevailing racism within British universities are nothing new. There are concerns that the level of on-campus racial discriminations could be even higher, as most of the incidents are not reported. According to reports, a quarter of ethnic minority students experienced racial harassment but avoided reporting them due to several reasons. A senior British professor has also acknowledged institutional racism in the UK universities.
Black and ethnic minority students have for long been victims of institutional racism in the universities of Britain. However, it seems British universities have not done enough to combat the racism, as their students believe that their complaints were mishandled. According to a Guardian report, universities fail to handle tens of thousands of complaints about racist incidents annually. A research from the Equalities and Human Rights Commission was published in 2009. Revealed some interesting yet embarrassing facts about racism at UK universities. The research suggested that one in four of the students participating in the survey had experienced racial harassment since their course started. Also, one in 20 students said that they left their course because of it. Moreover, two-thirds of students who experienced racial harassment avoided reporting it to their university. They were mainly concerned about being labeled as a troublemaker or feared that the complaint could affect their course, or believed the university would not take it seriously. Meanwhile, a report from the university's UK organization says that British universities are continuing to perpetuate institutional racism. The report also highlights a range of issues, including a lack of diversity among senior leaders, minority ethnic student attainment gap, and ethnicity pay gaps among staff. Only about 110 out of the over 18,000 UK university professors are black. In addition, only 3.2% of academic managers, directors, and senior officials are from ethnic minorities, and they are paid 16% less than UK-domiciled white officials and managers. Furthermore, black undergraduates have higher dropout rates. Professor David Richardson, the University of East Anglia's Vice Chancellor, who leads the university's UK's advisory group on racial harassment, says that British universities are institutionally racist. He acknowledged that racial harassment in universities is underreported and stressed the importance of providing support for the ethnic minority students.
Well, I think that people forget that the UK is still really a post-colonial nation. It's a post-imperialist nation in many ways, although that's arguable. And that carries with it its natural issues and problems. For instance, migrant issues, which are a fear factor and also a hatred. And you've seen an exponential rise in racism and racist political movements.
Revelations about on-campus racism in the UK come at a time when violent protests have engulfed the United States over racial profiling and police brutality against African Americans. Choking death of George Floyd in the U.S. city of Minneapolis sparked global outcry last year. Brits in more than 250 towns and cities also held anti-racism rallies during June and July, with some protesters toppling or removing statues of slave traders and vandalizing a memorial to Winston Churchill in central London.
The 46-year-old African-American George Floyd died on May 25 in the northern U.S. city of Minneapolis after a white police officer pressed his knee on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. He continually gasped, "Please, can't breathe," until his heart stopped. This incident triggered massive outrage against police brutality and racial prejudice. Demonstrators across the world have staged rallies in solidarity. Rallies known as the Black Lives Matter protests swept the U.K. last year as well. Protesters in Britain toppled or removed statues of slave traders, including that of Edward Colston in Bristol. They also vandalized a memorial to Winston Churchill in central London with the words, "Was a racist." There has since been a public reckoning with Britain's slavery and colonial past. The protests forced British authorities to take down or to remove scores of tributes to slave traders, colonialists, and racists across the UK.
Well, let me give one example, and it's linked to this university report that you've covered. Basically, let's take Oxford and Cambridge as institutions which are well known around the world, global institutions known for their so-called excellence in education. Well, they've been failing the black communities in particular almost systemically, and this institutional systemic structural racism is where the real danger lies.
Following the Black Lives Matter protest, a research shows the number of black people who said they have faced racial discrimination last year increased from 74% in 2019 to 81%. While the UK's past is not hidden from anyone, the Black Lives Matter movement shed light on one of the biggest faults within the body of this former colonial power, and that is racism.
U.S. President Joe Biden has been interrupted by a group of protesters as he began a rally in Georgia. They called on him to close private detention centers.
I want to thank you, the people of Georgia.
End detention now! End detention now!
We'll give you a microphone.
No! End detention now!
Folks!
Like you heard for yourselves, Biden responded, "I agree with you. Give me another 5 days." In January, the U.S. president signed an executive order that ended federal use of private prisons. Democrats hailed the move as an important step, but there have been calls for more action. Opponents of private detention centers say the facilities are linked with racial injustice. They also say the centers perpetuate mass imprisonment. Well, after the U.S. presidential election dispute and unrest, few expected the extremely polarized nation to completely rally around eventual winner, Joe Biden. After 100 days in office, Biden remains strongly supported by Democrats, but also deeply opposed by Republicans. His first few months have featured some major successes, but also major criticism. Rami Mazoheri is in Chicago.
After a still deeply disputed election, new United States President Joe Biden has reached 100 days in office with a lower approval rating than any other newly elected president since 1953, excepting Donald Trump. Many believe the country is only in a temporary political calm, which could be broken with the reported return of Trump to the political rally circuit in May.
Well, I don't know if the honeymoon is over. I think in some cases the honeymoon was over a few days after the inauguration, or even before the inauguration.
Biden finally gave his address, where he also unveiled a 10-year social infrastructure plan, which is expected to get many months of pushback from Congress. Many say Biden has had some successes. The coronavirus vaccine distribution, the $2 trillion infrastructure plan, ending the Muslim travel ban, and returning to the Paris Climate Agreement. But Biden has already backtracked from campaign promises in many vital areas. The fight for $15 per hour, the amount and length of unemployment payments, total household stimulus payments, dropping Medicare eligibility to 60 years old, student debt relief, reversing Trump's tax cuts for the rich, and more.
He's reneged on everything he promised, and he comes up with an excuse. I can't do it, or we can't do it because one guy's voting against it. We can't do it because the parliamentarian has decided we can't put it in the bill. I mean, people are pretty much aware that these are lame excuses, and that the Democrats, and Biden especially, are just using these lame excuses to not do what they said they would do.
At 100 days and amid similar economic disaster, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had passed 15 major bills which established hugely influential initiatives. Contrarily, Biden's $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package didn't establish a single long-term program. On foreign policy, Biden has adopted almost all of the stances of his controversial predecessor. He has not lifted sanctions on Iran nor returned to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. Russia's foreign minister said Biden's refusal of diplomacy and lack of respect could make relations worse than even during the Cold War. He has not taken Cuba off the state terrorist list, and he adopted Trump's widely criticized low quota for asylum seekers despite a crisis on the southern border. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Kyrgyzstan says its death toll from the latest border clashes with Tajikistan has climbed to 13, according to the Kyrgyz Health Ministry. Scores were also injured in the clashes. The country says over 10,000 citizens have been evacuated from two districts where the fighting was intense. Tajikistan has said two people were injured in the violence. On Thursday, security forces from the two countries exchanged fire, and residents hurled rocks at one another in a clash over water reservoir. The two sides announced a ceasefire later on that day, but shooting was reported during the night. Over a third of the border between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan is disputed. Dozens of Israeli ultra-Orthodox are killed in a stampede at a Jewish ceremony in the town of Meron. Hospital sources say at least 44 people have been killed in the accident and scores more have sustained injuries. Search and rescue teams say they struggle to evacuate trapped people because the site was so densely populated. The accident occurred at the Lag BaOmer event, in which tens of thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews were attending. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described the incident as a disaster. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned as a coup the decision by the Palestinian National Authority president to delay parliamentary elections. Hamas said the postponement of the polls does not agree with the national consensus and popular support. Mahmoud Abbas said he delayed the elections until voting is guaranteed in Israeli-occupied Jerusalem and Quds. Hamas had earlier called on Palestinians to explore ways of facing the elections in Al-Quds without the permission of or coordination with Israel. Abbas's Fatah party and its rival Hamas had agreed to hold legislative polls on May the 22nd. Hamas was expected to do well in elections, while Fatah's prospects have been threatened by splinter factions.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
کتاب الله.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 21 of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
فَإِذَا عَزَمَ الْأَمْرُ فَلَوْ صَدَقُوا اللَّهَ لَكَانَ خَيْرًا لَهُمْ.
Obedience and upright speech are all that is expected of you. So when the matter has been resolved upon, if they remain true to Allah, that will surely be better for them. Recall, in our last Friday's explanation of the preceding ayah of this surah, we had said that while true believers stand steadfast and fearlessly defend their faith, even if it means martyrdom in case of jihad or striving in the way of Allah, those who pay lip service to Islam are scared to death in such a situation and run away under different pretexts. This is surely a sign of hypocrisy. The ayah that we recited to you now means to say that true faith requires obeying God and His Prophet and refraining from undue pretexts, because such moves might undermine the morale of others and prevent them from participating in the fight against the enemies. In other words, it would be better to speak and act wholeheartedly when the declaration for defense or jihad is decisive, since this will lead to your honor in this world and great reward and salvation in the hereafter. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, faith requires righteous speech and acting in accordance with God's commandments rather than what we desire. Number two, jihad against the enemies who are bent upon mischief is among the divine commandments, and a true believer never props up any pretext to evade active duty. And number three, obedience to God and the Prophet's instructions is to our benefit, both in the transient life of the mortal world and in the hereafter. Now let us listen to ayahs 22 and 23 of this surah.
فَهَلْ عَسَيْتُمْ إِن تَوَلَّيْتُمْ أَن تُفْسِدُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَتُقَطِّعُوا أَرْحَامَكُمْ أُولَئِكَ الَّذِينَ لَعَنَهُمُ اللَّهُ فَأَصَمَّهُمْ وَأَعْمَى أَبْصَارَهُمْ.
May it not be that if you were to wield authority, you would cause corruption in the land and ill-treat your blood relations? They are the ones whom Allah has cursed, so He made them deaf and blinded their sight. If those who violate Quranic injunctions, that is, the disbelievers and the hypocrites, take control of affairs and assume authority, then they would prepare the ground for corruption and mischief, including the ill-treatment of kith and kin. For this reason, it is incumbent upon the believers to take part in jihad in order to prevent the enemies from carrying out their sordid plans. The address here is to the frail of faith, and means to say that by escaping jihad, such people should not think they have saved themselves, because their deserting paves the way for corruption and slaughter, with deadly consequences affecting all. In other words, the hypocrites are reprimanded for their opportunistic attitude so that they refrain from doing mischief and severing ties of kinship as they used to do during the pre-Islamic times of ignorance. The next ayah means to say that such people, that is the hypocrites, who spread corruption and sever the ties of kinship, incur divine damnation, as a consequence of which God has made them deaf to the words of guidance and blind to the signs of truth and realities that are all around. From these ayahs we'll learn that, number one, those evading jihad do not really save themselves, but are the cause of corruption, mischief, and bloodshed which affect them as well. Number two, violation of divine teachings weakens family bonds and results in fratricide. Number three, God Almighty has damned those who cause corruption and undermine blood relationships. And number four, eyes and ears are useful only if properly used, since there are many people who, despite possessing healthy faculties of listening and sight, are unable to heed the words of guidance or understand the truth. Now let us listen to ayah 24 in conclusion of this week's episode.
أَفَلَا يَتَدَبَّرُونَ الْقُرْآنَ أَمْ عَلَىٰ قُلُوبٍ أَقْفَالُهَا.
Do they not contemplate upon the guidelines of the Qur'an, or are there locks on their hearts? This ayah is a warning to the people of weak faith who do not ponder on the timeless wisdom of the Noble Qur'an in order to benefit from its guidelines, since the heavenly scripture is not solely for recitation, but is a book of thought and mediation. The unfortunate state of such people lies either in their carelessness toward this supreme symbol of divine guidance, or in their lack of perception owing to the insensitivity of their hearts, which are occupied by vain desires and the vicious acts they had committed. In other words, the one who loses way in darkness is either blind or does not carry a light, which means hypocrites are sick at heart and fail to benefit from the Noble Qur'an. All believers must contemplate on the wordings of the Noble Qur'an, as God has said in Ayah 29 of Surah Sa'd, which said, a blessed book that we have sent down to you so that they may contemplate its signs. That's why, on the Day of Judgment, the Prophet will complain to God of how the Muslims had left the Noble Qur'an alone, and this loneliness of the Noble Qur'an is in two ways. Some of us Muslims recite it a little, while those who recite it do it in a parrot-like manner without pondering on its concepts or practically following its guidelines in daily life. Thus, those fail to benefit from the unlimited bounties and timeless wisdom of the Noble Quran in accordance with the guidelines of the Prophet and his infallible successors actually lock their hearts from truth because of either ignorance or prejudice. This is the reason for the myriads of problems prevailing in the society and the lack of Islamic unity. This ayah teaches us that, number one, the Noble Quran is not merely for ritual recitation, but it should be properly read, reflected upon, and put into practice. Number two, all Muslims are duty-bound to contemplate on the timeless wisdom of the Noble Quran. And number three, the failure to contemplate on the Quran results in locking of the hearts towards the truth, and the result will be blindness of the lofty concepts.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. The third round of negotiations on reviving the Iran nuclear deal is underway in Vienna. Now, to that end, Tehran has come up with more detailed conditions, including guarantees to benefit from the deal this time, and for the trigger mechanism not to be activated in case of sanctions reimposition for whatever reason. Now, Tehran is setting the conditions to ascertain its economic benefits under JCPOA, to which it has adhered without benefiting much. Now, we'll have a report on details of Tehran's demands in the Vienna talks, and then we'll put that issue up for debate with our panelists. Stay tuned.
Iran and the remaining signatories of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are holding a new round of talks in Vienna in an effort to save the nuclear agreement nearly 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. As talks continue over a spat of issues, the Islamic Republic has reiterated its demands for returning back to compliance with the JCPOA. That's according to two sources who informed Press TV of the conditions.
Iran's demands regarding JCPOA talks. The United States must remove sanctions that prevent Iran from benefiting from the JCPOA. Legal institutions will accept the outcome of the Vienna talks only once all U.S. sanctions are removed and the removal is verified by Tehran. The United States has to guarantee that it won't use the snapback mechanism after rejoining the deal. The United States has to pay for the losses it inflicted on Iran by withdrawing from the JCPOA.
According to the sources, the United States has to guarantee that foreign companies cooperate with the Islamic Republic following Washington's rejoining of the agreement. Press TV analysts say COTSA and Iran Sanctions Act, visa bans, the dollar U-turn, and Section 311 of the Patriot Act are fundamental obstacles to Iran's gains under the JCPOA. Press TV analysts say among such obstacles are also a number of U.S. President's executive orders that prohibit transactions with respect to Iran and block property of Iranian individuals, governments, and financial institutions. They also say failing to remove sanctions, a 120-day or 180-day sanction waivers, also deprive Iran of benefits stipulated under the JCPOA. Observers believe Tehran has reasons to persist with its demands.
Iran has experienced so much deceitful measures under the nuclear deal by the United States, and the U.S. deceitful measures have inflicted harms over the deal. So Iran is trying to block any such move in future.
The JCPOA revival talks come as Iranian officials have time and again warned that Tehran will not allow the negotiations to become attritional. Iran's top negotiator in Vienna and Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the Islamic Republic would stop the negotiations if it detects that the other side lacks seriousness, tries to buy time, or seek to add new topics to those under discussion. Iran insists that the 2015 nuclear agreement can only be salvaged if its demands are met and that its conditions are the country's definitive policy. Former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. Tehran, however, waited for a year, gave leeway to the European signatories to make up for the U.S. pullout, but the so-called E3 failed to abide by their commitments. Now, with the new U.S. administration in office for nearly 100 days, Washington has so far failed to take any solid measure to return to the deal. All in all, Iran says the ball is in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all the sanctions on Tehran, or pursue the failed policy of predecessor, known as maximum pressure campaign, and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic.
Okay, that was Mehdi Fahmy, reporter. And there, let me invite my guest. We have analyst and political commentator Mohan Abedin in our studios tonight with us, and also Iranian affairs expert Karim Sharara, who's joining us out of Beirut, the Lebanese capital. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show. In our studio first, Mohan, I want to ask you about Iran. Iran keeping reminding the interlocutors in the Vienna talks that this deal will survive only if all the sanctions are removed and that, you know, at a go. Why is Iran insisting on this and keeping reminding the U.S. especially about this?
Well, this is the fundamental Iranian position. I mean, this is the bottom line from Iran's point of view, and it reflects Iran's experience with the JCPOA over the past 6 years. Even during the Obama administration, when the nuclear deal was first agreed, very few sanctions were actually lifted, and the Obama administration kept dragging its heels. And Iran, let's not forget, only agreed to restrict its civilian nuclear program for complete sanctions relief. That was the original deal. And even Obama reneged on that. And we all know what happened when Trump came to power, a unilateral U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. So this Iranian position reflects a very bitter experience. Mm. And the Americans have actually withdrawn from this deal unilaterally. First of all, by principle, it makes sense that they should actually revoke all the sanctions, all the JCPOA-related sanctions, mm-hmm. the nuclear sanctions, and all the Trump-era sanctions before Iran actually decides to come back.
You mean they're the ones to take the first action first, because they were the first ones to leave.
This, I think everybody would agree, even some people in the American administration, it makes total sense for the Americans to make the first step as a confidence-building gesture. But also, again, let's not forget Iran's bitter experience with the JCPOA, mm-hmm. and that's what actually determines Iran's position and Iran's demand that all sanctions, they not only have to be lifted, they have to be verifiably lifted.
Right. Okay, now let me turn to Beirut. We have Karim Sharara there. Karim, it seems that the United States is complicating the revival of the deal because it's refusing to lift all the Trump-era sanctions on Iran. That's what Tehran is asking. Why is that?
To the very beginning of the talks, I mean, you can see that from the get-go, the United States was intent on lowballing the Iranian side. They would not commit to anything. They were not going to commit to a verification of the sanctions relief. They weren't going to commit to long-term to anything beyond their current administration with regards to the to the deal itself. So I think they were just biding for time. And I think if we go back to Ayatollah Khamenei's speech before the talks, you can clearly see that he was very observant with regards to the Americans' intents, because he told the Iranian team that they should be wary of the talks dragging on. And I think that's what the U.S. was counting on. I mean, there were two versions of this all, before the talks started anyway. The first version was that the United States wanted a speedy resolution and a speedy reconciliation with Iran so that they can influence domestic politics in Iran. bringing back a more moderate president. But then Ayatollah Khamenei said about the talks dragging on, then you had another version, which was that the United States wasn't intent on a speedy resolution to all of this, but really wanted to talk, the talks to drag on so that they can keep lowballing Iran and reach a more something that would be more suitable to them without giving any reasonable concessions to the Iranians. So now that the Iranians team has gone back to the talks with a renewed spirit, if I might say, not only asking for sanctions relief and not only asking for the United States to go back to the JCPOA as it was, not only asking for guarantees, no, they're now asking for compensation as well, which
That's
is
right.
which is what they should have done in the first place, actually, because if you see that the United States is going to lowball you, well, you're going to have to raise the stakes if you want to reach a suitable
I'll come to that point also, Inertia. Now, let me ask Mahan, you know that Iran had been in full compliance with the nuclear deal as it was endorsed by IAEA multiple times, 14, 15 times. Mm-hmm. And yet the country did not enjoy much from the, I mean, economically from the deal. So that is why that this time around, in order to stop this from recurring, Iran is asking for guarantees so that if anything should go wrong, Iran knows at least that it can continue with its business even for a certain period of time. So let's have your comment.
Well, absolutely. Well, one of the key Iranian demands is that at least for the next 4 years, sanctions have to be lifted. Not only that, but the foreign companies that were operating here as part of the post-JCPOA settlement, they should be able to operate here without fear of sanctions or anything related to that for at least 4 years. Mm-hmm. There's, of course, the demand for compensation, which our colleague in Beirut just set out. But also another key Iranian demand is that the so-called snapback power, which other signatories have, this should be revoked. Because of obviously the Trump administration tried to do that. They initially withdrew withdrew unilaterally, but then last September, in a very odd move, they tried to snap back sanctions, and that really backfired totally against them. But nevertheless, again, in principle, this snapback option is inimical to the whole spirit of the deal, and this should be revoked. But look, the most important thing here is that sanctions have to be verifiably lifted. I mean, the only reason Iran has agreed initially 6 years ago to cut back on its civilian nuclear program was that its economy would not be under any pressure. There would be no sanctions. We could trade and engage with the world at a financial, economic level without any kind of coercion, without any kind of hindrance. This should come into fruition immediately. So there has to be verification of the sanctions lifting process. And look, Iran is in a position where it has plenty of leverage. This is where I slightly disagree with our colleague in Beirut. The United States is in no position to influence domestic politics here. I don't think that's part of their game plan here. What the Americans are trying to do, basically, is trying to offer Iran a kind of a watered-down deal, putting Iran in a difficult position, again, without guarantees. So we agree to yet another nuclear deal, and in a couple of years, we again start experiencing difficulties. Another scenario is that the Americans are going for something like JCPOA plus, something that was also discussed during the Trump administration, you know, add more conditions to the JCPOA, for instance, bring in elements of Iran's national defense power or issues very sensitive to Iran's national security. This is an absolute no-no. The Iranian leadership from the top down has made it quite clear that JCPOA is a nuclear-specific agreement, and it stays at that level. Any kind of discussion about Iran's national defense power is an absolute taboo. It's not going anywhere.
Exactly. Let's get it over with this and implement it, then we can talk about other things, if possible.
Yeah.
Now, Karim, the Islamic Republic did not benefit much from the nuclear deal once it signed it, and since former President Trump took the U.S. out of the JCPOA and thus prevented foreign companies and banks from trade and transaction with Iran, Iran even started losing instead of gaining anything from the deal. So naturally, this is what you're alluding to. Tehran should be compensated for all those losses, maybe a couple of trillion dollars, if I remember right, shouldn't it?
Well, if you take into account that the American administration's comportment towards Iran, I mean, this wasn't defensive in any way, and this wasn't just a case of trying to contain Iran. This was done with malice. Maximum pressure is about causing maximum harm to Iran and the Iranian people. I mean, for example, if you go to the U.S. Treasury, you will see that they really specify that these sanctions aren't meant to harm the Iranian people, as they claim. But if you put these into practice, I mean, most of the food companies and most, if not all, pharmaceutical companies during the Trump administration tried to stay away from Iran as much as they could, even though they could have dealt with Iran. But they were really afraid that the United States would have gone after them under any kind of pretext because they dealt with Iran. So although the United States comportment was that of leaving a humanitarian space for dealings with Iran, this wasn't implemented on the ground. This was done with malice. They wanted to harm the Iranian people. So this was done with criminal intent. Should the Iranian side be compensated? Yes, of course they should be compensated. But is this going to happen? I don't think that the United States would agree to such a measure. It's like you said. I mean, just being back in the deal and having it implemented as it should have been implemented is more than sufficient. If you take into consideration, for example, the fact that the wording of the deal was in such a way that the sanctions would be suspended and not lifted or removed. Well, that's one thing that should have been taken into account. Mm-hmm. Another thing that should have been taken into account is the fact that, well, yes, the nuclear sanctions were lifted, but these sanctions could have been brought back upon Iran under any kind of other pretext. Call it ballistic missiles sanctions. Call it anything else. Whatever. Call it, say, sponsoring terrorism, if you will.
Right.
This is what the Iranian side is trying to debate now, that is trying to negotiate against. If you want to bring back, you cannot bring back the sanctions any under different pretext, be it nuclear or be it anything else.
That's true. That's why Mohan is also saying that verifiable means removing all these.
Yeah, our colleague in Beirut actually raised a very important point, is that, look, even during the Obama administration, a lot of these sanctions were so-called suspended or waived. This is not good enough. They have to be lifted. They have to be abolished.
For Iran to be able to benefit.
Absolutely, yes. And so there has to be clarity on that. And there has to be verification. And from my understanding, from reading the appropriate literature and listening to the appropriate people, that will take at least a few months. So nobody should be in a hurry here to reach an agreement.
Because it's all the sectors.
Yeah. So to reach an agreement within a few weeks or a couple of months. No, no one's in a hurry. Iran actually, again, our colleague is right. The Trump administration imposed this so-called maximum pressure campaign with a lot of malice. It was with criminal intent. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But the other side is, it didn't work. The Iranian economy proved to be far more resilient than most people gave it credit for. So we've survived this for 3 years. Mm-hmm. We can survive it for sure for another 3 years. It's, nobody's in a hurry to come to a faulty agreement. So if we're going to reestablish the JCPOA, to reseal the deal, so-called, you know, it should be done properly on sound foundations. And at minimum, again, our colleague raised the issue of compensation. That's a key Iranian demand. But I think, first of all, at minimum, these sanctions have to be verifiably lifted. Another issue is that Iran has rejected, not necessarily the so-called step-by-step issue. If the Americans want to do it incrementally, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But they shouldn't expect Iran to go for a step-for-step process. They do something, Iran does something. Iran has rejected that. But if the Americans want to take their time and lift this slowly, that's fine. But Iran will only go back into compliance once all the JCPOA-related sanctions have been verified.
That's right, and Iran has made it pretty clear.
So the nuances here are very important. So it's very important to have a full grasp of the details here, because we all want an agreement, but it has to be on proper foundations for it to be sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let me ask Karim. Karim, you know that so far all the sides in Vienna are speaking of progress being made, and while at the same time admitting that major issues do remain. And the U.S. delegation is also there in attendance, and that's despite Iran rejecting direct talks with it. Now, what would you expect to come out of the Vienna talks?
I think it's very optimistic to say that that progress is being made. I mean,
that's what negotiators have been saying.
The talks have been shrouded in a lot of secrecy, but they've been saying that ever since the beginning. I mean, President Rouhani has said the 50 to 70% of the hurdles have been overcome, but then you go to the American side and they barely say that 30% of it is done, or 30% of the hurdles, that is. So progress is being made. Well, okay, if you want progress to be made, then it should be upon the major step. They should be able to agree on the basics at the very least. I mean, I'm really not optimistic about the future of all this, especially since I mean, if you take into consideration the comportment of the Biden administration ever since they came to power. You have China, you have Russia, and you have Iran. They're triple threat. So what they've been able to accomplish so far is antagonize China, not only antagonize Russia, but bring a lot of European countries close to war with Russia. And now you have Iran, and they're not going. I don't think they're going to risk a deal with Iran at such a particular point of time when they need to amass, when they need to bring their allies in the Middle East close together. Not unless you have two fronts that the Americans have to deal with. Opening up a third front is foolish, but if anything, the Americans are going to work on destabilizing Iran domestically. I mean, that's proven to be their track record so far.
Okay.
I think things would be going if they see the deal as a way to undermine Iran's progress on the economic level. If you look at Iran's track record...
Kerry, if you allow me, I get one more question, if we have time, I'll go back to you. And Mohan, we have heard that the White House is saying that the U.S. and Israel have agreed to set up this, what they call, working group to discuss Iran's drone and missile program. And have you heard of that, and what would that group do?
If they want to do that, that's fine. But that's independent of the JCPOA. That's their problem. If they want to... I mean, Iran is well within its rights to develop its national defense capability, and Iran is never ever going to accept any restrictions on any of that. If they want to have their own working group to track Iran's progress, that's fine, that's their problem. Mm-hmm. But none of these can be brought into the JCPOA discussions. This is an absolute red line.
Okay.
And as far as I know, they haven't been raised, and hopefully they will not be raised. Just one issue about the progress. I think this is not really time sensitive. Nobody should be in a hurry. You know, as I said, Iran actually withstood Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign for 3 years. Mm-hmm. The Iranian economy proved resilient. Yes, the Americans wanted to destabilize this country, but they didn't succeed, and they cannot succeed.
If you allow me, I'll give Karim 30 seconds. Karim, go ahead, 30 seconds.
Okay, basically, I just wanted to say that what you now have is Israeli-Saudi rapprochement. And I think that's a really a priority for the Americans, because they need to bring their allies closer together. What with Iran scoring so many victories in the region over the past few years, so if they need to face Iran at the regional level, that's what the Americans are going to be working on.
Okay.
They cannot give Iran a favorable deal if it's going to empower it in the region. If anything, they're going to try to undermine Iran through the deal, and that's what I think that what they were shooting for when they wanted to go back to the JCPOA, because Iran has shown its commitment to the JCPOA, to its diplomatic relations. But when they try to undermine it through any other means...
Okay, you got to jump in. We're out of time. I'm sorry for interrupting you. We're just out of time. Let me thank our guests. We had analyst and political commentator Mohan Abed in our Tehran studio, and also Iran affairs expert Karim Sharara, who joined us from Beirut.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. The discussion that we had in our previous show was actually working and analyzing a doubt or misconception which was posed by a so-called scholar from extremist groups on the concept of occultation. A part of that actually doubt was answered in our previous session, and now we want to see what do the narrations mean by the number of 6 days or 6 months or 6 years that are mentioned usually for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. A reason that made him to say that these narrations are contradictory and there is a sort of contradiction in this series of narrations. We wanted to nullify this contradiction, and an introductory answer was given to that doubt. But now we are going to ask the respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, to shed some more light on this very important issue. What do narrations mean by this number of 6? Does it have anything to do with the mystery of numbers in narrations, like what you mentioned in previous session about the numbers of plenty, of like, for example, 70 in some narrations, when it is said that, for example, doing this action equals 70 years of worship. Does it really or literally mean 70 years or not? This is what we want to listen from the guest of this show, Sheikh Murtada Karimi. Sheikhna, bismillah. Salam and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam and thank you for having me. The narration is from Imam Ali alayhi salam. In that narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam is asked, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, O the commander of the faithful, Kam takunu al-hayratu wal-ghayba? How long is the time of the occultation of Mahdi? He says, Sittata ayyam, 6 days, aw sittata ashhur, or 6 months, aw sittata sanin, or 6 years. This Wahhabi scholar, he says that the Shia scholars, they invented this narration. This is a fake narration because they wanted to give a hope to the Shia who lived right after the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, that it's not a long time, and after few days or few months or few years, Imam Mahdi will reappear. So he wants to try to show and prove that a series of narrations were invented by the Shia scholars to give the Shia hope. First of all, as I mentioned, this is only one narration in this regard.